Guys, how are we?
Pretty good.
Very good.
Good. We had some unfortunate news last today actually. So last week we forced Patrick to wear a shirt, and as a result of this, he's gone into a prolonged period of incubation. So he's not to be seen on this series for a little while. But in his place, we're more than delighted to be joined by one of Patrick's partners, Shub. And general partner at Foundamental. So, hey, Shub, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for
Hey,
having me
sure.
over. It's such a pleasure to speak with you. Speaking both of you.
Of course. Okay, so today we're going to discuss. Actually, we're going to go down under. How is that for a cliche statement about when talking about the Australian market? So, we're going to discuss a company, and in fact, it is one of Shub's favorite subjects, supply chains.
Yes.
And this company has just recently raised a Series A of 2.9 million Australian dollars. How does that, does anyone know how that converts to US?
So it's actually, believe it or not, it's more volatile than you may think. And I think in the last 3 or 4 years, one Aussie dollar got as low as 0.57 US dollars and as high as 0.75 dollars. So in other words, that's a 30% swing between the
That's a
lows,
lot.
which is a lot. It's a lot for an advanced economy currency.
What does it mean, Shub, in terms of like economics between those two countries?
So it's quite fascinating, right? So, and we just dive right in. It's one of the reasons why I love in the, looking at Australian businesses as much, because excellent Australian venture-backable businesses are designed to be global from day one, or at least expect to have a global thinking from day one. What that means is, if you're, primarily going to be based in Australia and targeting the external world, a depreciated Aussie dollar actually makes your business more competitive in the global market. So it's actually not necessarily a bad thing when the Aussie dollar gets a bit weaker relative to the US dollar. Quite often I've met founders who are actually quite happy, even if that means the notional temporary value of their company, which let's say it's reported in AUD, gets lower, it actually enhances their near-term commercial prospects.
Okay.
So, in the fa in the in the like fa startup terms, it's a net benefit for Australia in that case.
Quite often, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And what's some so something significant that we read when researching this company? The company is Matrack. Did I say that right? They're one of the they so weirdly, and I suppose this is like maybe another Western cliche, is they're using some of this money to expand into China.
Yeah, I was going to ask
Interesting.
this.
Yeah, very interesting take. And also part of the investment or the people within included within the fund were a Chinese VC as well. And this just rarely happens, especially when we speak on Bricks and Bytes and within the circles of people we speak to. So Martin, you were going to ask about this. Do you have a specific view?
So my view is not like expert view, but before we give it to Shub, so my thoughts and what I heard is that US is like close US or Western world is closing itself in terms of like China Western relationships. It was very interesting to read that the Matrack is expanding to China. So I don't have anything else to say really on this, but I'm just very curious, Shub, on your thoughts on Western
Sure.
startups expanding towards China and like what does it mean? Because it seems like there's the capital moving out of China if they can run out of there rather than coming in. So what do you say to that?
Yeah, would you want me to comment on that in the context of Mantrack or Matrack or the wider, I guess, narrative around the Western firms wanting to expand into China?
Let's go
So
wide
let's
and then
talk.
go
Yeah,
Mantrack.
and exactly.
Yeah. Look, so the interesting thing, right? And I'll take like a 5 year view on how our thinking on this has evolved. So if you look back to 2019, 2020, and the reason I'm starting here is actually that is the first time we met Mantrack back in the day. In many advanced economies around the world, China was the largest trading partner. So even to this day, China is by an enormous distance Australia's largest trading partner. And for many advanced economies, it is either the largest or the second largest trading partner. I mean, for a long time, China was the US's largest trading partner. And just to, on the benefit of our viewers, what I mean by trading partner is the economy within which a country does the most imports and exports. until recently, in fact, I think until last year, China was the US's largest trading partner. Now, recently, Mexico has taken that position. In many economies in Europe, China still is the largest trading partner, right? So therefore, one would imagine at least that that piece of information would suggest that there's obviously a lot to be gained by enabling market access into China or enabling cross-border trade between these economies. Because as we always think, there's inefficiencies you can exploit to create venture-backable opportunities. Now, what I think has dramatically changed in the 5 years that we've seen, while China still is, if not the largest, in most of these countries, still the second largest trading partner, the trend has not been the friend here at all, right? And I think while the absolute quantum of trade is still very significant, what has clearly come into the picture here is policies that a Western company, or let's say, let's take the example of an Australian firm or an American firm or a British firm, et cetera, wanting to set up a subsidiary or an entity in China. What you really want is clarity that you know what the contracts represent, what the laws mean for your subsidiary, how it will be treated vis-a-vis your parent company, how moving cash or moving resources into China, and then you want to withdraw those resources back into the parent company, how all of these things will work, because that is what gives you and your shareholder certainty to make capital allocation and resource allocation decisions. Now, what has happened, either in real terms or certainly in rhetorical terms, in the last, say, 3-4 years, a lot of such decisions have become a bit difficult to predict with certainty in China. In the sense, do you know for certain what you're up against when you're drawing capital back into your parent company from a subsidiary in China? Do you know exactly what happens to the way IP is treated and how business resources can be consolidated within a parent company? I think, look, by no means am I a geopolitical expert, but what capital allocators, public markets, you know, as mature as public markets or as early as VCs, hate, absolutely hate in any situation, and is uncertainty.
Politica especially.
Exactly. So I'll think of it this way. The more certain you are of the situation you're in, the more your willingness to pay would be in terms of multiples you'll be ready to pay, the amount of capital you're ready to deploy. And the more uncertainty you introduce into the system, you withdraw capital, and the less of a multiple you're ready to pay, because you just, in your mind, you assume a lot more things can go worse or bad in general. And I think that in general has resulted in, so look, what has already happened, you know, may exist or eventually get dissolved in some, or exist, continue to exist in some capacity. But when it comes to net new capital allocation decisions to go into China, I think now the time is not quite right, just because of this real or perceived uncertainty with how policies may change.
So in the case of Matrak, then, why, if that is the case, then any ideas as to why they may be considering this expansion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think maybe now it would be a good time to touch upon, you know, our interactions with Matrak. So we first met them back in 2019. In fact, Shane and Simon, so Shane Hodgkins, the founder of Matrak, and Simon, who previously was a director at Matrak, now he started his own company called One Breadcrumb. They even were kind enough to host me in their Melbourne office. So guys, if you're listening to this, shout out to you. So I was actually, I think when I think of it, it's a very powerful vision, just to, I guess, put a spotlight on what they do. The movement of materials and construction is, of course, a very opaque supply chain and a very difficult one to track in real time. So if I were to capture what they do in a nutshell, it is like an end-to-end integrated visibility system where you go from as early as design drawings and conceptualization stage schedules, link them at every stage of the project to where the materials are in flowing in the supply chain. And it sort of feeds back into the drawings and the schedules in real time. Whereas in a, let's say, a traditional or the status quo in construction is all of these are separate workflows. You maintain your drawings in one set of documents or one set of softwares. you maintain your schedule somewhere else. Someone else tracks the delivery schedule. Someone else maintains the bill of quantities, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea is to sort of have a centralized repository that connects all of these things in real time, which, as you can imagine, is a very powerful, a very profound vision statement, and which is why there's much to like about the company, which is why, you know, we've kept re-engaging and stayed in touch. So we, as I mentioned, we first met them in 2019. We reconnected with them in 2020, and intermittently we have stayed in touch with them since then as well. There's a lot to like. Sorry, did you want to jump in with a question here?
No. So I just wanted to like kind of summarize what you say, if I understand the product well. So it's like a consolidation of the design management and supply management within one thing, one product. Do I get it?
Yes.
Correctly?
To provide real-time visibility of the status. So to give you an idea, say you're building a home, right? And there's like one part of your room, which has, let's say there's a window component that's been designed, and that window component shows up on the 3D design drawing, and the installation of that window shows up in the schedule or the project schedule for the home. Now, in a traditional status quo world, what would happen is one of the subcontractors would have a bill of materials for the window. Another subcontractor, or maybe the architect or the designer, would maintain like a drawing which sort of says, okay, you know what, this is the stuff that is eventually going to be built. There'll be another subcontractor responsible for delivery of materials, or maybe the head contractor interacts with all the suppliers. And in each of them, they're tracking, hey, you know, have the materials been delivered, et cetera. It's a manual process. For example, tracked over spreadsheets or emails or WhatsApp messages and the like. Now imagine a platform, which is what Matrack represents as a promise, is you sort of centralize all of this. So for example, if you take a drawing and you zoom in on that window, it tells you, hey, where are we on that window? You know, have we ordered the components for it? Are they in transit? Are they in the warehouse? Have they already been delivered? Etc. Etc. Has some installation work for the window already commenced, and you can repeat this sort of real-time visibility across each and every component in the structure.
Brilliant. Sounds useful. So is it on the? So the clients are contractors, general contractors, builders.
Generally speaking, could be head contractors, and then the reason I use the term head contractors is that's the expression used for general contractors in Australia. Could be those, could also be home builders, for example, could also be installers of components like windows, doors, and these kinds of companies. Now, you may be wondering, hey, is that an oddly specific niche to be targeting? And I think this is where the topic of our today's discussion comes in. And I don't know if that stat still holds up today, but an enormous proportion, I think somewhere between 50 to 70% of doors, windows, and these sort of finished components in Australian homes is imported from China. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if it's even more than 70%. Yeah. So which is why it's a significant problem statement for window manufacturers or window brands or installers to actually track the delivery of these items from China and to have visibility over when it's going to be here. Are they delayed? Are they on time? Etc.
Yeah. So I think linking it to the is actually almost like a unique factor that Matrack would have versus some competition, because it's almost like they're using this central information base that everyone has access and visibility to, whereas with some solutions that may not be accessible to everyone else. And it's also very recognizable and like it's understood by the entire or each stakeholder that's involved in the project. But to my head, it also sounds very complicated to be able to do that. Like, I don't know how technically they managed to do it, but is it like overlaid on drawings from when they exit the design software, or is it like layered onto their through the software that they build, like on a web app or something like that? And because within supply chain there's so many moving parts, like, how does it stay updated and keep up to date? These are just my observations. I'm not saying sure that you would necessarily have the answers.
It's a great question. The truth is, obviously, it's a very profound value statement and value proposition. It's a very complex set of things to build and put together as part of the same platform. And I guess to the extent that we can have like a discussion without revealing too much. So think of it combining the aspects of a, project management platform, because you're kind of centralizing your workflows in, or the ambition at least to set is to centralize workflows on one platform, combine it with some sort of, not necessarily design, but at least visual inspection capabilities of specific components in a design model. And the real-time tracking, you need stuff like the ability to integrate with either QR codes or IoT, etc., transmit that information and have real-time ability for the platform to communicate that to you. It's a lot of things coming together. And obviously, since we have introduced the real-time tracking component, a lot of these things are in transit somewhere, you know, maybe not always with the best internet infrastructure, etc., or out at sea, for instance. And therefore, you need a system that is robust enough to handle different form factors and by which this information is transmitted.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. So you guys look into MathTrack in 2019, 2020. Did mm-hmm. you invest? If yes, why? If not, why?
No, we did not actually end up investing, even though, you know, as you may have gathered from our conversation, there is much to like about MathTrack, and I still find much to like about MathTrack. I think eventually what made on my mind, and I encourage you to think back to what the narrative was like in 2020, especially if you think back to what, say, mid-2020 was, Australia-China rhetoric, I have to say, was very, very intense. It probably still is, but it was extremely intense, with a lot of Australian exports into China being banned as like in a retaliatory response, basically. And I guess it's not the right forum to talk about why it was bans were being imposed by China on Australian exports or Australian exports to China. And I just felt, is this like a situation where there's enough uncertainty in my mind as to how this could these trade wars manifest into something that I'm not able to foresee or predict right now? Or to make it even simpler, do I have enough confidence on how the bilateral relationship will go in the next 5 years? In full honesty, I did not. I did not, and it did not give me a whole lot of conviction on my ability to predict what's going to come. And I think the reason why it affected my decision or my thinking in this deal more so than it typically does in other deals is actually, you know, even though, as you guys mentioned in the recent announcement, the investment is meant to further MathTrack's expansion into China, but MathTrack always has had a significant focus on China. And, you know, to be honest, from their perspective, I can see the rationale. As I mentioned, an overwhelming share of imports of construction products and finished products that are used in the Australian market do come from China. If you have to make a dent in that slice of the Australian housing and construction market, you're not going to do that without making a decent show of it in China. So I can see both sides of the story here, but ultimately in my mind, the uncertainty of it all, I think, got weighed on me a fair bit.
Okay, talking about uncertainty and geography then. So you guys are invested in a company in a similar geography. I don't know if that's correct, but like, yeah, it's for me, as someone that just lives in this side of the world, that's the eastern part of the globe, called Inframarket, which are also tackling the issues with supply chains, but specific to India, I believe. And I'm not sure if they've expanded to other regions. And as humans, we like to compare. So Shubh, I'm interested, are MathTrack and Inframarket along the same kind of lines, or is the model and all different?
And did your ignorance just put India and China into one country?
I had to be very careful with how I worded that, yes.
I mean, to give Owen the benefit of the doubt, he thought of it more as like a Eastern, or, you know, relative to the UK, if you sort of go due southeast, these countries sort of fall in the same sort of general direction.
Yeah, so north to south is easy because we have a hemisphere line that separates us, right? But east to west is a little bit more difficult to articulate.
Especially in historical terms, but let's not go there.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, look, so there are overlaps to the extent that there's obviously a lot of material flows cross-border involved in both companies. Although in my mind, I think they are very, very different companies. You know, Inframarket does a lot of things phenomenally well, but I think can we claim to be a very technology heavy company, allowing for real time, visibility across all stages of the project. I mean, we offer visibility or improved visibility of project relative to other building material suppliers or general contractors. Yes, but I think that's the bar there, I must admit, is very, very low. And therefore, they clear that bar. Do they match up to Matrax bar and real-time visibility? Absolutely not. But in my, at least in my opinion, and I'm biased here as an insider in Inframarket, they solve a much more foundational problem of just the quality of the supply chain and the reliability of the supply chain. If you are alluding also to Inframarket also being a cross-border play, yes. So Inframarket does export a lot of its products all over the world. So stuff like tiles, granite, natural stones, electrical products, wood-based products, for example. A lot of those Inframarket does export to many other parts of the world. But admittedly, Inframarket by itself is not equipped to handle or provide all the technological capabilities that a Matrax would. I mean, if that was your question, an Inframarket and a Matrax could, in theory, work together to sort of offer a fully visible supply chain, visible in real time, always.
Yeah. So before the episode, when I was doing some research, I could put these two companies like in the same category. But after you explained Matrax, straight away, it was clear to me that they are doing something different. So I wanted to touch on the charging structure.
This is your last question, by the way.
Fine. Charging structure of Matrax. If you know anything about it, really, like, well, how do they make money? What's the like a charging structure? So I'll just give an anecdote that I was looking at at some startup earlier today.
I wish you which is in that to me.
Which is in the climate tech. And when I looked at the structure, the pricing structure, there was like a fixed price per month, let's say $500. And within that, there was X amount of like data points, like 10,000 data points. But every other data points on top of that, you could purchase for, let's say, ATP. And I think it's like very, it's not the best way of charging really a customer. Like, what are your thoughts on this?
Look, I think addressing the first part of your question, from what I recall, at least back in the day, the pricing was very much like a typical subscription plan. You pay a certain price for per user. If you want even more features or more capabilities or more processing ability, for example, in terms of greater usage to be allowed per user, you pay a higher price. So it's not freemium per se, but it's paid, and there's premium tiers to the pricing. That's what I believe they maintain for a few years. I don't know if they have additional elements to their pricing today to, for example, tap into even larger users. And there's specific tiers or specific value-add products and services which they monetize separately. If they do that, I think that would be very smart. That's certainly how I would advise, you know, if I were to be an insider in Matrax or if I were involved with a similar company, that's what I would advise them to do. The second part of your question, just if I may understand correctly, was your question on the, I guess, the benefit of pricing it on a per user basis, or would love to understand your question better.
Yeah. So from the customer's point of view, so the customer is paying a fixed fee for like a monthly fee plus as an add-on if they exceed like a data point number, they pay extra, let's say ATP or $1 or £1 for each and every data point. So I think from venture point of view, and someone who invests in startups, that's a good thing. From the customer's point of view, I think it's a little bit tricky situation.
The way I want to think of these things is any model can work. You know, the success of each model depends on the choices and the trade-offs you're willing to make. And so to give you an example, right? So say the likes of Microsoft, Oracle, SAP, I mean, there is no such thing as or historically at least, there was no such thing as a free or freemium model that they would have. Every user would be charged a certain fee. And, you know, if you want more capabilities or more usage, you pay more. But of course, we are familiar with other models like either open source or free and freemium models where an overwhelming share of the users, maybe as much as 90, 95%, maybe even 99% of the users pay nothing. And they still get access to a free product. But a small share, anywhere between 1 to 10% of the users pay for premium products, right? And I think even as individual customers, we are familiar with these sorts of pricing patterns on apps of the App Store or the Android Play Store, for example. Now, that doesn't mean one is superior to the other. Great companies have been built with both models, but there are trade-offs to be made. So what that means is, if, for example, you're a firm pushing a freemium or an open source type strategy, you need your underlying infrastructure needs to be able to support a decent workable product for a much larger user base. So your backend infrastructure requirements go up. So say, for example, if the addressable market of paying users is say 1 million users, but you're also now serving another 10 or 20 million users who are using it for free. So you cannot design your infrastructure or your team for just 1 million users. You have to design it for 20 million and 21 or whatever, 20 million plus users, and yet find a way that the 1 million users who pay support the whole business economics. If you can find that sort of pricing model and that combination of features and stuff, by all means, I think that that can work. And if, for instance, you are designing a company, a more traditional SaaS company where nothing is free, everything is at a standard price, what that means is you're limiting your addressable market in terms of number of potential clients, and then you've got to make it work. So what I always like to say is, are you ready for the choices and trade-offs that come with your pricing decision? Because any approach can work if you segregate them in a manner that you're comfortable with and you're prepared to stick with it for the next 10 years or more.
Very good.
Brilliant answer. Thank you.
So Shubh, we were fortunate to spend some time with you guys this week in Berlin, and we got onto the topic of dinners. Should VCs make their own dinners? And I was just thinking, one of your answers was actually that you like to cook, and as you're as you are spending the weekend here in the UK, what is your favorite British cuisine?
Okay.
Oh my god!
Okay, you went in really intense there. Okay, so firstly, it was our real pleasure to host you guys in Berlin. What a tremendous time we had! Can't wait to do it again very soon. Favorite British cuisine?
Non-existent. Non-existent.
I was about to say, in my mind, favorite and British cuisine don't belong together, dude. They don't belong together.
Okay, how about you, Martin? What's your favorite British cuisine?
My favorite British cuisine. My favorite British cuisine is Indian food and Dishoom.
Oh, Dishoom is nice. Dishoom is nice.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah. Okay. No, but the roast is enjoyable from time to time.
You know, my first tryst with British cuisine, I think that was like what, maybe almost a decade ago. And at that time, I didn't even know this thing existed. But maybe you guys now have tried all of this. Deep fried Mars bars. Have you tried this?
So it's a real thing, yeah. I've never tried it.
I have. And someone told me, hey, it's like a, I don't know if it was Scottish or whatever, maybe traditional Scottish cuisine. I was like, how can that be traditional? What is traditional about deep fried Mars bars? But I mean, and I tried it. It's also intense. Let's go with that. It's also intense to have.
Yeah, so Scottish have some interesting cuisines like haggis. I don't know if you came across that before. I don't know how far it goes for Brits. Fish and chips, not my kind.
What's your favorite? What's your favorite British cuisine?
I'm totally with you. Like curry made in England, like if you go to like Brick Lane or somewhere around there, you can get good food.
Yeah. That there are brilliant Indian restaurants in London, especially in central London.
Yeah, they really are.
Yes.
Okay, that's guys. Right. Thank you, and thank you, Shubh, for joining us. Maybe you're joining one in the future too.
I look forward to it. I hope this is not the only time we speak. I'm sure there'll be many more to come.
Of course.
Definitely not. Yeah,
thank
you. It was
a real
much.
Pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Shubh.
Thank you.